Welcome to Gynecologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Robert Coleman, and to begin, he commented on two recent papers he co-authored focusing on the initial management of ovarian cancer and the evolving concept of optimal cytoreductive surgery and the decision, based primarily on laparoscopy, on whether to proceed directly to surgery or use neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
We feel very strongly that this is probably one of the key decision points in a patient who comes with a new diagnosis. We'd like all those patients, regardless of whether or not we feel like they're good candidates, to be at least evaluated by a gynecologic oncologist because of the importance of the surgical question. Our friends over in Germany did a really nice study where they collected about three of their essentially negative chemotherapy trials, and they looked at the outcomes of surgery across the conglomerate of that about 3,500 patient cohort. And they showed that while patients with less than a centimeter residual disease, which was previously called optimal, did better than those that had more than one centimeter disease, the real difference were the patients who had no visible residual. So what we did is we've kind of redefined what we consider as optimal. Optimal being that there's no visible residual. And what that did was that if you look at the cohort of patients going to surgery, we used to say about 75% of those could be made optimal with a good surgery. Now that number changes to about 25-30%. And what we tried to do is figure out a way to increase that number. And that's kind of what led to this personalized approach to surgery.
What are some of the elements that go into what you call, you know, a personalized surgical approach?
So we adopted that model using R0, meaning no visible residual, as the go, no-go kind of decision. So we then, and this was not an easy undertaking, I will tell you, because when you have 21 gynecologic oncologists like we do in our department, getting them all to agree to do it this way was in itself reportable. But we did. We had a retreat, and we got everybody on board and said, listen, we're going to try this. We're going to use this algorithm for screening patients. We're going to validate the scoring system. And what our hope is that we're going to improve outcomes because the R0 rates will increase in both groups, not only the neoadjuvant group, but also in the primary surgery group. So that's what that figure is representing. What we needed, though, is we needed some type of quality control. So that's why there's a second surgeon built into that algorithm. We started this algorithm in April of 2013. And so every case that was taken to the OR who had a scope had two independent reviewers of the degree of the tumor that was in the peritoneal cavity. And so we assessed that against seven specific points, and each of those got either a zero or a two. For patients that had eight or higher, those patients were then triaged to neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and those was a score of zero, two, or four, or six were then triaged to primary surgery.
What did you see in terms of consistency of the first and second opinions?
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you asked that question. We actually reported this at the SGO. So if your listeners want to go back and look at that, they're certainly welcome to look at our slides from that. Alpa Nick was the primary presenter. So we found an amazing consistency. And we did this a couple ways. The first was to see whether or not the go, no go. So in other words, the neoadjuvant versus primary surgery benchmark was reached. So there was exact agreement on the scoring in about 50 to 60%. But in terms of the triage to surgery versus chemo, it was about 96%. There were only two outliers, essentially, where one surgeon scored in the operable range and the second surgeon scored in the non-operable range. And those were essentially then triaged by a third person. And so the third person would come in and be the arbitrator, and then the decision would stick. And that was part of our agreement amongst our faculty, was that we would follow this algorithm. And if the arbitrator was necessary, we would follow with what the arbitrator said.
How much of whatever difference you did find was the result of sort of different findings at laparoscopy as opposed to interpretation about what to do?
It was more about, like, you probably have seen pictures of the peritoneal cavity of a patient with ovarian cancer. A lot of these discrepancies, and they were usually very narrow. So it was like six by one person and eight on the other. It had to do with the issue of like confluency of disease on the diaphragm or an assessment of whether or not the bowel infiltration was resectable or not resectable. It was those kinds of assessments where one person might have called it a zero and another person would have called it a two. And so otherwise, kind of not huge differences.
What kind of neoadjuvant regimen do you use and what does it accomplish?
So the standard of care for primary ovarian cancer is still a platinum and a taxane doublet. And it's really the nuances are whether or not this should be given intraperitoneally. Is it dose dense? In the U.S., for the most part, bevacizumab, which has been approved in Europe in primary setting, is not globally used, mostly because it's not covered by insurances in most states. Particularly here in Texas, it's not covered for use in primary setting. So for most of us, it's either a Q3 weekly or a dose-dense decision for a neoadjuvant patient.
And what does it accomplish? How often do you think patients in a switch from being, you know, what would be residual disease to no residual disease?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, we're looking at that as a specific endpoint for the patients that are going to surgery, you know, after neoadjuvant therapy. You're probably pretty familiar with in breast cancer that this pathologic complete response rate has actually been looked at as a potential accelerated approval option for novel therapies. And the pathologic complete response rate to just chemotherapy after, let's say, 3 or 4 cycles of chemo is very low. It's about 5%. It's been 5% in our hands, and it's been confirmed by one European study that the expectation for response is high, but the expectation for pathologic complete response is actually quite low. So one of the things that we're looking at is when we introduce new treatment into this surgical algorithm is whether or not we can actually adjust that rate up and see if there may be some options for similar accelerated approval therapy.
What about the path CR rate when you add in Bev?
We don't know. In reality, for patients getting new adjuvant chemotherapy, they'll only get the 2 cycles before surgery because we have to stop the, you know, cycle 3 before the anticipated surgery and won't start it until cycle 5. So cycle 4 in a post-op setting, it would be Bev naive. So we just don't know what that rate is and whether or not it's adjusted by the use.
We're going to talk later on about the exciting development in terms of PARP inhibitors, particularly in BRCA-positive patients, but also ovarian cancer in general. Are there trials or are there any data in neoadjuvant PARP inhibitors?
No, not quite yet with neoadjuvant, but we just launched the first study of a PARP inhibitor being used in combination with paclitaxel and carboplatin. As you know, this has been a really hard thing to do. There was one trial that was done in the recurrent setting, study 41, which was given paclitaxel, carboplatin, and olaparib. And they had to do quite a bit of dose modification to get the triplet in. It's just more toxic, myelosuppressive when it's given that way. But the current trial, GOG-3005, which just launched, is actually combining veliparib in combination with paclitaxel and carboplatin. And that, as I mentioned, just started.
Any interest in sort of chemo followed by PARP inhibitor neoadjuvantly?
Sure, and that's actually the subject of several ongoing trials. The SOLO-1 trial, which is now included accrual, is looking at olaparib as essentially a maintenance treatment.
But again, neoadjuvantly.
Well, it's given in patients who got frontline therapy. And then at the completion of frontline therapy, then they're randomizing.
Any other surgical issues that you want to comment on? Maybe, I'm not going to say mistakes, but myths or misperceptions or things you would do differently when you see people coming in for second opinions?
Yeah, the major thing is that they come in for second opinion. What we're concerned about is that with the availability of these 2 randomized trials, non-inferiority trials showing that chemo and surgery seem to be non-inferior to each other, that there may be a lack of an opinion, a surgical opinion by a gynecologic oncologist. So we're trying to get the message out that, you know, as part of the normal workup, if a patient sees a medical oncologist first, that they at least get an opinion regarding surgery by a gynecologic oncologist to make an assessment as to whether or not surgery is feasible and would be of value in the patient.
These are patients with disease outside the abdomen?
No, not so much that, but, you know, even patients that have pleural fusions, some of those patients have the effusion because of migration of the fluid through the diaphragms. But it's more about when people see a CAT scan of a patient who has diffuse disease in the abdomen, there's kind of a freak out moment. And they say, oh, well, we need to debulk that with chemo first before you go to surgery. But in reality, many of those cases are operable. And that's why we wanted to advocate strongly that these patients be seen by a GYN oncologist first.
Interesting. I would not have guessed that, but that is interesting. Getting back to the issue of neoadjuvant treatment, in other tumors, particularly breast cancer, this setting's been used to look at short-term predictors of response to systemic agents. Anything like that going on in ovarian cancer?
You know, there was a really interesting report that came out at ASCO a couple years ago that identified a cohort of patients who had an immunophenotype that essentially did very poorly when they were given bevacizumab, actually worse than expected. And actually, it's not, you know, now that we know more about what happens with Bev in the microenvironment, that actually makes some sense. And we're actually designing a trial right now, which will hopefully take advantage of that inducible effect of a immunophenotype in the microenvironment that would provide a survival advantage for the cancer cell. So I thought that was quite interesting. It's very hard to reproduce that kind of thing in a per-patient basis, but as a population, it does raise a lot of new hypotheses. Outside of that, we've not been able to come up with, you know, really clear biomarkers. There was a study that was put together looking at the GOG-218 study that was looking at, you know, levels of VEGF to see if this could be predictive of outcome. And again, there's these associations, but actually identifying on a per-patient basis of who's going to respond and not is still somewhat problematic.
So speaking of bevacizumab, you were involved in some, as you have been for a long time, critical clinical trials looking at that. And at the SGO meeting, you presented a phase three, or I don't know if you were the one who presented it, but you had the paper, phase three randomized trial from the GOG, the 213 study. And then at ASCO, I see that there were more data reported on patient-reported outcomes from this trial. Can you talk about that study and what you think it means?
Yeah, the GOG-213, for those people in the audience who know me, know that that's been my baby for about 10 years, maybe even longer. It's been a long time coming, and it's a very difficult trial to do because it's evaluating two endpoints. It's evaluating the impact of bevacizumab on paclitaxel carboplatin backbone. That's what we reported on at SGO this year and the quality of life. It's also looking at the role of secondary cytoreduction, which is another one of those highly biased, you know, interventions that has yet to have data. So we were the first to essentially launch a randomized trial for surgery in the recurrent platinum-sensitive setting. The trial is still ongoing. We are very near to close the enrollment on the surgical arm. The chemotherapy arm is closed for some time now. And so what I reported at SGO this year was the outcome data for the Bev versus no Bev question. So the other interesting piece about this particular trial is compared to the other trials that have been done in this space with anti-angiogenesis drugs is that this trial's primary endpoint is overall survival. So as you know, the OCEANS trial showed a PFS with no OS difference with adding bevacizumab to gemcitabine and carboplatin. This trial was looking at those outcomes in platinum-sensitive patients with paclitaxel and carboplatin backbone. So essentially what we showed was that there was, you know, as expected, there was a big PFS difference, the hazard ratio about 0.6, and an improvement in that on the median of about 3 months. But what was really remarkable was that in the overall survival, we showed that there was a very nearly statistically significant improvement of about 5 months in overall survival. And the reason I say it was nearly is that the confidence interval for the 95% confidence two-tailed test was at 1.005. So P equal 0.056. So it's very, very close. And I think most of us feel that this is probably clinically meaningful. And so we'll see how this plays out. But there may be something about the taxane Bev combination in recurrent disease that's important, and maybe more important than some of the other combination backbones.
What was the hazard rate for reduction in the improvement in survival?
It was about 0.8283.
And what about the secondary surgery?
So secondary surgery is still ongoing. At the time that we reported the study, we had 107 patients that had participated. One of the things that we realized was that the hazard ratio for the subgroup, this is a pre-planned subgroup of, it's actually a stratification variable, that those patients that went on to surgery actually relative to the whole sample size have a hazard ratio of 0.55. So these are very different patients that are going to surgery. Whether or not there's going to be a benefit with the addition of the chemotherapy strategy on top of that surgical benefit has yet to be determined. But what we're finding is that the events are very extended. So it may be a few more years before I can report on the surgical question.
What's your approach outside a trial setting to secondary cytoreductive surgery?
So I think the retrospective and the very few limited prospective trials that have been reported basically come back to a very simple principle. Surgery doesn't work if the patients aren't chemosensitive. So we know that chemosensitivity is a function of the treatment-free interval after the primary treatment is completed. So the longer the treatment-free interval, the more chemosensitive these patients generally are, and those make the best candidates. The other is that patients that are not optimally, meaning R0 resection, they probably just don't benefit that much. And again, this is probably a function of the what I just mentioned as the first factor, which is that long treatment-free interval. So patients with limited sites of disease and long treatment-free intervals are the ones that I feel are the best candidates. Now, that varies among different people. In my mind, I like to see patients that are outside of what our median, you know, progression-free survival is, which is somewhere between 12 and 18 months. So I like to see somebody after 18 months who has, you know, one or two or three sites of disease that can be completely resected.
What is the current role in your own practice outside a trial setting of bevacizumab in ovarian cancer?
I would say that the majority of the use that we have in my practice is in the resistant setting, mainly because it's also FDA approved on the basis of the Aurelia trial. And I tend to use it a lot with weekly paclitaxel or in combination with gemcitabine and cisplatin. And the reason I like that specific triplet combination with the gem-cis in resistant patients is that you can give the gemcitabine and the cisplatin on a two-week schedule so that you take advantage of the drug-drug synergy that those two drugs have. And then you can add the Bev on a Q2-week schedule as well, so they get essentially all three drugs every 2 weeks.
Any situations where you would use it upfront?
Well, if we could, we just can't get it reimbursed. I still think if I could have it reimbursed, I probably would still use it on frontline setting patients that weren't on trial. I still think that our best shot at making anybody go into durable remission is the very first time they see treatment. So that would be the way to go.
Let's talk a little bit about PARP inhibitors, and you've been involved with the research on several. You, again, at SGO, had a paper looking at olaparib monotherapy in patients with germline BRCA mutations. You were also a part of a study looking at veliparib, another PARP inhibitor, again, in breast cancer it's been looked at. And then also a couple of papers, one just at the ASCO meeting, an oral presentation on rucaparib. Can you talk about these three agents, what you learned from these studies, and where you think things are heading?
Well, I think, you know, the use of PARP drugs is a really exciting, you know, aspect of ovarian cancer management at this point. I think probably the most exciting piece of this is that we know these drugs have single agent activity in the patients who are most likely to respond. Those would be the germline carriers or the somatic mutation carriers of BRCA1/2 mutation. What's interesting is that there's probably a bigger audience out there for whom these drugs would be of benefit. And there are some very cool combination strategies that are being developed and I think also provide some new opportunities to move this whole field forward. So yeah, I think that in terms of these drugs, probably the most frequent question I get, because we're also working with talazoparib, I think the most frequent question I get is like, what distinguishes these drugs? And that's actually quite hard. I mean, you know, if you add niraparib in there, that gives us a total of five, you know, different agents that we are working with. They seem to all have activity in patients that carry germline mutation. There's a little subtlety in the difference of to what degree they induce a PARP trapping type of mechanism of action. But I think overall, all of them, with the exception of veliparib, have been very difficult to give in combination with full-dose chemotherapy. So the development plan is basically following what olaparib have gone, which is look at it first in patients who have the vulnerability, so the BRCA mutation carriers, and then to try to expand that audience as a single agent for those that carry homologous recombination deficiency aberrations.
So when you talk about homologous recombination deficiency, are you talking about a specific assay or you just kind of treat everybody? What is the difference in response, for example, to what you see with germline mutations and without?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that the data emerging with the other drugs, the one I know the most about because we've got the data, it was actually prospectively designed, is the rucaparib trial. So in that rucaparib in the ARIEL-2 trial, which is what we reported, what we did in that trial is we took a cohort. It was, you know, essentially open to all comers with platinum-sensitive disease. So they had to have platinum-sensitive disease. And then we had three kind of buckets, if you will. We had a bucket of patients who carried germline or somatic mutation and BRCA, and we capped that enrollment at 40 patients because we knew that we wouldn't need very many patients to show that there was efficacy there. But then we left the trial open for the next 180 or so, 170 patients to sort out whether or not there was a biomarker that could use to distinguish them. And in this particular assay, what they were looking for was loss of heterozygosity across the genome. So the strategy was that, and I thought this is really interesting, this is probably important for your listeners to know, is that there's probably 40 or so genes that are involved in homologous recombination, and they're broad. For instance, P10 is implicated as a gene that's involved in homologous recombination. It's part of the sequence of events that are important for that kind of, you know, high fidelity DNA repair. But not all of those genes, when they're isolated, are actually sensitive to a PARP. And one of the things that we saw early on was that there was a wide spectrum of sensitivity, you know, the synthetic lethality that you get by knocking out any one of those HRD genes is not the same. So what we decided to do, at least in the ARIEL trial, was to look more globally. Rather than focus just on the genes that are involved in HRD, look across the whole genome for the amount of scarring. It almost falls into that MSI kind of idea that we're seeing now with the immune therapies. You know, you look at a global inability to repair. And so that's what they showed, was that when we looked at the response rate in the patients that were low loss of heterozygosity and non-carrier of BRCA mutation, the response rates were very low, about 10%. In the patients that had the BRCA mutations, of course, the response rates were very high, and all those patients had high LOH. But the patients that were wild type for BRCA, either in germline or tumor, but had high LOH, they had an intermediate response, about 40%. So it showed that, you know, that's a pretty decent response rate to a drug in a patient that doesn't carry a BRCA mutation. And so that's where I think these other, and this isn't unique to the rucaparib program, but it's obviously going to be repeated in the others.
What about clinical tolerability? You know, we are hearing people now that olaparib is out there talk about GI problems. What do we know about these various PARP inhibitors and side effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it was one of those things that you learned when you treated your first patient and they were calling you back in a couple days that they were having all this problem. So we learned early on that we needed to anticipate that. So I would say that right now we still get those problems from time to time, but we provide the ammo for the patients to take care of it ahead of time. We counsel them extensively about what it is so that they anticipate that it could be coming on and have them start medicating themselves right away so they can take care of the GI side effects.
I'm always curious about people's individual cocktails. What exactly do you do? And what about the other PARP inhibitors? They cause the same problem.
Yeah, it's a class effect. We see it across the whole spectrum. And every single one of the drugs I've worked with, we've seen it as a problem. I just think we've gotten better at it. We give them ondansetron, either as a slow release or as the pill form. We give them compazine. And it's mostly not so much necessarily the cocktail as it is the anticipation. So the patients just have to have that second sense about when they think they might be nauseated. Because remember, these are lots of pills. It's not like it's one pill and you get through it. You got to take several of these pills. You know, the olaparib formulation before it went to the tablet, it was taking a lot of capsules twice a day. So, you know, if you have a GI side effect, it's a hard thing to do to stay on drug. And this is, like I said, it's a class effect. So we use that and we use aggressive education and do it that way.
What about the anemia? Is that also a class effect? And how exactly do you deal with it?
Well, we see it a little bit. I haven't yet had to transfuse somebody, and I've had several patients on for a long period of time. We do see some transient anemia. Some of the drugs, it's a little more than the others. I mean, I guess we'll see this when we see the full spectrum of the clinical data, but we have seen that there might be a little bit of a differential between the drugs with regard to that and also with myelosuppression. We've seen some of the drugs myelosuppression. But, you know, in reality, when you get to that dose, it's really a dose effect, and all the drugs can produce all those side effects if you get to the right dose.
Let's talk a little bit about your cases, and maybe we could start out with the cervical patient, because we've talked a lot about ovary, but why don't we start out with your 37-year-old lady?
Yeah, so, you know, this was a patient who was diagnosed with the stage 1B1 squamous cell carcinoma of the cervix, and she had what a lot of patients would have for this, and that's a radical surgery to remove the uterus and the lymph nodes, and she had negative margins and negative nodes and did well for about 2 years, and then came back and presented with this hoarse cough and vague abdominal pain. And as you know, most patients, anything that looks as a deviation from their normal setting brings them in, and that's indeed what happened. We did do a PET CT, and she had suspected disease that was extending all the way up the chain, and she had a mass in the lateral pelvis that was associated to the sidewall. And, you know, a lot of people will ask, well, how could that happen? I mean, you had a radical hysterectomy with negative margins, and you had negative nodes, so how did it happen? And what we're coming to realize is that, you know, there is probably this issue of a stem cell that does reflect this particular tumor. And there's also several nodes that are essentially not potentially in the nodal chains that are resected. So we still are using relatively imprecise methodologies, although I will say, and the reason I wanted to bring this particular case in, is that we're doing a lot more sentinel node mapping now with cervical cancer. It's a story that we've been looking at for more than a decade. But I think that the experience is starting to gain that we're finding some of these lymph nodes in weird places. And so that's probably what happened here, that there was a node in the area that was missed, maybe above the surgical field as well, because the periaortics aren't necessarily always looked at if the pelvic nodes are negative. And in a 2-year period of time, she had growth of tumor.
That's interesting about the sentinel nodes. So if the sentinel nodes are negative, you don't pursue dissection?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're trying to validate the sentinel node thing. So yes, right now we're still doing the nodes, and then we're also doing the basins to make sure that we'll know what the false negative, false positive rates are.
How often do you see disease outside the pelvis at first relapse?
You know, it follows the rules of thirds. So about a third of the time it's in the pelvis, a third of the time it's outside of the pelvis, and a third of the time it includes both. So it's kind of that same mixture.
So before you talk about what happened to her, which is that she went on a trial, I want to hear about that. But outside a clinical trial setting, how would you analyze the decision options at this point?
You know, it's a great question for cervix cancer patients because we know these patients are very difficult to achieve not only response, but certainly very uncommon that they'll actually be cured of their recurrence. So the decision, it really comes down to the same decisions we make with any of our patients that we induce a therapy on, and that's to look at the risk-benefit for institution of therapy. The difference in cervix cancer is that the response rates are just not that great, and their expected survivorship is also limited, you know, relative to some of the other more chemosensitive diseases we deal with, like endometrial and ovarian cancer. So that's a really fair question. And when I counsel patients, I always tell them that I got to be their advocate on this. And if I don't feel that the treatment's actually going to benefit them versus the toxicity, that it's not worth doing.
So if the patient is going to be treated, what kind of treatment do you think would be standard in this situation?
Well, fortunately, now we have FDA approval for the use of bevacizumab with chemotherapy. And that's why I put down that she was treated on GOG-240 because it was the trial that led to that approval. And it was a very nice trial that was looking at the use of bevacizumab or not in two different chemotherapy backbones. The other piece that's interesting in this case that was reflective in the trial was that she had a long duration of time before her first recurrence. This has kind of showed up as a cofactor among the history of chemotherapy and cervix cancer. There seems to be a potential treatment-free interval where patients who have longer off-treatment exposure might actually respond better to a platinum retreatment.
What was the time point at which she was diagnosed with recurrence and put onto the trial? How long ago?
It's about 2 years or so now.
And can you talk about what happened?
So basically, we put her on treatment and she actually got a complete response, which was remarkable. We were very excited. One of the differences in this particular case is you might see in a normal situation is that the patients might have had chemo radiation to begin with, and then they're retreated. And what we know in that situation is that patients that have chemotherapy and radiation who are treated with chemotherapy again, there's a differential of response for in-field and out-of-field failures. So the response rates in general are higher in patients who have out-of-field recurrences. So they're not limited by the poor vascularity of a chemoradiation area. So this patient wasn't a good candidate for radiation because she had such diffuse disease from the pelvis to the neck. And so while you could use radiation as a palliative modality for, you know, the pelvic disease, she essentially had a chemo-naive state. And that's why I think she had such a good response to treatment. So she did have a complete response to therapy and actually went NED for about another year and change, and then ultimately recurred and then went on to, you know, really a very short list of ineffective treatment.
I'm just kind of curious, though, in terms of this issue about the radiation, to what extent does prior radiation affect the ability to dose the drug in terms of marrow tolerance?
Yeah, that's a great question. Oh, my gosh. This comes up a lot, and I think that it's underappreciated by a lot of people, so I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah, it depends on how much of the marrow was radiated. I think when the pelvis is radiated, you're getting up close to that 20% of the marrow reserve if they get standard pelvic field for cervix cancer curative treatment. So that's a pretty big chunk of the marrow reserve that these patients have. It's worse if they get periaortic radiation as well, so the extended fields. So yes, it can affect the dosing. In these trials, we have abbreviated the dose a bit so that they could get the therapy repetitively. The one thing I'll say is that unlike ovarian and endometrial cancer, the expectation to get 6 cycles of treatment is actually quite a bit lower.
So I'm curious, when she went into CR with the chemo bev, did her hoarseness get better?
Yeah, no, so that improved because that happened to be a recurrent laryngeal nerve kind of impingement from the nodal thing. In fact, that was one of the very first things she noticed, or at least I noticed, is that I said, wait a minute, your voice isn't as hoarse anymore. And she's like, yeah, it seems to be getting better.
What did you do upon progression after having this great response? And are there any situations, you know, this is a big debate, particularly in colon cancer, there's even a trial looking at continuing bev on progression and changing the chemo. Any situations where you ever do that? And what was her next therapy?
Well, that's a good question. And we're actually investigating that in an ovarian trial right now as well. In cervix cancer, you know, what we will typically do and what we did with her is we basically kind of keep her on this until intolerance. And I think in this case, we kept her on bevacizumab, but she developed some problems with it, and then we had to take her off. There was a period of time where she was just being observed. When she recurred, I think my first kind of step was to go back to a platinum combo with something different than with paclitaxel. So I used the gemcitabine cisplatinum regimen that I had mentioned before for cervix cancer. And, you know, it worked a little bit, I would say. I mean, we went through one assessment cycle without progression, but then it looked like it had progressed through, and then we put her into a phase one program.
Interesting. You mentioned that she had some kind of problem with Bev. What was the problem, and what kinds of problems do you see in general in these patients?
Well, in general, for cervix cancer patients, you know, most of these we see with recurrent disease have had radiation, so we see complications from that frequently. In this particular situation, it wasn't that. We were running into problems with proteinuria. Actually, I tried to dose reduce the Bev, actually, because I do think there's a dose response to some of the side effects that we see, certainly with hypertension and with the proteinuria. But, you know, it was kind of one of those things. She was kind of getting worn out just from the chemotherapy exposure. This was kind of an additional annoyance. And that kind of just led to us to finally say, listen, I don't know how much benefit we're getting out of this. We've done it for several cycles. And then that's how we kind of came to the decision to stop.
That's interesting. Did she have hypertension also?
Yeah, but it wasn't something that was unmanageable. She was on a single drug.
It's interesting. You don't hear too many patients with significant proteinuria on Bev in any cancer, although occasionally you've heard about people who've even gone into the nephrotic range, and you get into this question of, you know, well, now they're benefiting from treatment, but how big a deal is it to be nephrotic? How bad was her proteinuria?
Well, like I said, it was more of an annoyance. So I wouldn't say it was the thing that was dose limiting. It's just that it was, you know, in the constellation of the symptoms and the treatment course and all that, we just decided to take a break.
What about bowel perforation? And as long as I'm bringing it up, bowel perforation also with ovarian.
Actually, in cervix cancer, what we see even probably more so is fistula. So, you know, they're already at risk because of the poor vascularity, and we do see that. And I've seen several cases where they've developed fistula on Bev, on 240, like regimens, and then we've stopped the Bev and the fistula is actually healed, or at least got to be less of a nuisance. The bowel perforation risk across the GYN spectrum is still coming in around 2 to 4% when it's done in the right patients. I think we learned early on that, you know, women with inflammatory bowel disease and those that have bowel obstruction are terrible candidates for the drug, and I absolutely don't use it in those situations. So I think the more selective that we've become, the lower the rate of the adverse event.
How about your 71-year-old lady with endometrial cancer?
So she's 71. She kind of came in with the usual postmenopausal bleeding, and a biopsy showed a grade 2 endometrioid type tumor. And interestingly, she also had these bilateral ovarian masses that were present on her imaging, and unfortunately some omental thickening. And so before I had seen her, she had gone to the operating room, and she was found with this grade 2 lesion that was invading into the myometrium by 2/3, and she had some lymphovascular space involvement. And in the ovaries, she had a similar grade 2 endometrioid tumor that was on the surface. And so it was felt to be, rather than a synchronous primary, as a metastatic deposit. And of course, she had disease in the omentum. So when I saw her, this had already been done. And the imaging, when I saw her, also showed that she had some ascites and had some peritoneal disease. And the ascites was actually somewhat problematic. She was wanting it tapped. It was more of a, you know, it was heaviness and all that. So I saw her essentially as a second opinion regarding treatment, and she had been given the recommendation of paclitaxel carboplatin. And so when I saw her, I told her that would be a completely reasonable thing to do. We have a lot of data to support that. But I also had a trial ongoing, which was looking at the role of dasatinib in combination with paclitaxel carboplatin. And so she went on to that trial.
What was the rationale for dasatinib?
We've had a lot of interest in the specific target called FA2, EphrinA2. And FA2 is a very unique target for a lot of cancer biology because it's lost. It's a part of neuronal development in the fetal tissues, but it's lost in adult tissues except in cancers. It's also activated. It has activity, essentially, in a phosphorylated and a non-phosphorylated state. And so we started a program about 10 years ago trying to find a way to target the specific protein and the specific gene because it was so prevalent in a number of different tumors and seemed to drive a lot of biology for invasion and metastasis.
And what's your current situation?
So the way this trial was written, and we haven't reported this yet, but I'll just give you the highlight of this trial. The way I wrote this trial was that the dasatinib was actually given as an induction. So they got one course of dasatinib as a single agent, and they were biopsied before and after, before they started the chemotherapy triplet. And so she went on, you know, she had her ascites was a problem. The first cycle of dasatinib, we didn't see much change there, but it didn't get worse. And then when she went on the chemotherapy, the ascites dried up when we looked at her after three cycles of chemotherapy, she'd had a dramatic improvement in her peritoneal disease. And then at the end of six cycles, she had even more, although not a complete response at the completion of that. And she went on to three more cycles of the chemotherapy.
What's her current situation?
So right now, she's still on treatment with pectoscar platinum and continuing to do quite well. You know, as I mentioned, she's ERPR positive, which is a little unusual, but this provides an opportunity for another intervention that we're closely working on now as well.
What's that?
That's looking at the use of everolimus, letrozole, and metformin, which we've now shown in several of our kind of sequential studies to have be quite active in patients who have endometrioid ER-positive tumors.
That's really interesting. And of course, we've seen a lot of excitement in breast cancer with the CDK inhibitors, palbociclib, really impressive results at the ASCO meeting. It's already approved. There's another one. What about CDK inhibitors in endometrial cancer?
Absolutely. So our next trial, once we close the everolimus, letrozole, metformin trial, is to one with a CDK4 inhibitor.
So there's so many things to talk about today. We only got through about like two-thirds of them. The one thing I did want to ask you about, because you submitted a couple cases of ovarian cancer, and I was curious about this first one, the 60-year-old lady, for one particular reason, is that she got a whole bunch of therapies, you know, without going into all the details, this is over a period of years, and only very late in the game, so to speak, had BRCA mutation testing. And I'm curious whether, you know, you consider BRCA testing standard of care as soon as you have a patient with ovarian cancer.
I do. No question.
So you might find it interesting that when we were at your group, the SGO meeting last year, and we polled an audience of quite a few people, only 75%. Does that sound possible?
Yeah, it is. I think the message is trickling out. And again, some of that may be qualified too. So I would qualify and say that the non-mucinous ovarian cancer patients should be tested. Yes, I do. The availability of therapy and even strategy, I wouldn't even say even with outside of the PARP inhibitors, just strategy is going to be dependent on that. So yes, we need to get the word out.
We actually had a case of a patient who had been referred to hospice and had not been BRCA tested, got BRCA tested and responded to olaparib. In this situation, again, it looks like she got to you fairly late in the game.
So, you know, it was just remarkable. And this is a good message for, you know, anybody who's treating a patient. When you see somebody who's received this much platinum and responded this many times, there's something going on. Even if they're not BRCA positive in the germline, there's something else going on here. And so I had a high index of suspicion. And, you know, so we tested her and found out that, yes, indeed, she was a carrier.
And how long ago was that?
You know, this was about 2-3 years ago now.
Interesting. So what happened at that point?
So, you know, at the time we didn't have olaparib to give off trial, but we were able to get her into one of our PARP trials. She was like one of the two that we could recruit before the study closed. And she developed a response to this, even though, you know, it was so long afterwards with all the prior treatment that she had had.
And what happened subsequently?
So ultimately she did progress, but, you know, her performance status was actually still fairly good and her volume of disease was still relatively small. So she went on to, I actually kind of recycled through some of these regimens she had before because, you know, these direct DNA damaging agents actually are quite active in patients who carry the BRCA mutation. So I recycled through the gemcitabine and the platinum.
I next met with Dr. Bradley Monk. And to begin, he discussed the management of initial recurrence in patients with ovarian cancer.
So if the patient recurs within the first 6 months, that's a platinum-resistant recurrence, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But greater than 6 months is platinum-sensitive relapse. And when I say platinum-sensitive, I generally only mean second and third line. By the time you get to fourth and fifth line, things are very different. But this is second line. And it's, let's say that, you know, typical would be 10 to 12 months. She would have platinum-sensitive relapse. And again, I generally only begin treatment when there's measurable disease I can see. And why do I treat? Because I don't want her to get a malignant bowel obstruction or ascites. And it's a platinum doublet. And there are three commonly used platinum doublets. Retreatment with carboplatin paclitaxel, okay? Carboplatin gemcitabine, that's on label since 2006. Gemcitabine 1,000. Day one, day eight, the carboplatin is reduced a little bit because these patients have been pre-treated. When you use carbo with gem, it's only an AUC of 4. And then carboplatin pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And so it's clear, again, a carboplatin doublet, but the trick is to pick the second agent. Paclitaxel, gemcitabine, or pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And how you decide that is a personalized approach, convenience. The carbo PLD is every 4 weeks. Neuropathy, if neuropathy is a problem, you don't want to use paclitaxel, that sort of thing.
Looking back, though, in terms of this woman's presentation and her going to surgery, assuming she has a good response, you're able to do an R0 resection. What's the chance of a patient like that being cured?
Right. So a patient like this one, stage 4 neoadjuvant, the chance is almost zero. There'll be a few, but it's pretty low, maybe less than 5%. But in those patients where you're lucky enough, as you said, in the beginning to do an operation, and you can have an R0, as many as 20 to 30% of those patients can be cured. Yes, we can cure 20 to 30% of advanced ovarian cancer patients. And there was a recent paper this month, actually, and it was written up in many of the media, that in California, they reported on that. And they said, wow, patients are living a lot longer, and that's true. And it's not one specific intervention. It's good surgery, it's good chemotherapy, it's good supportive care, okay? So the preference, obviously, is frontline surgery if you can get away with it and have an R0.
So I want to get more into treating a patient like this as disease progresses, but just also pick up on another point that you brought up before in terms of intraperitoneal therapy. There have been a lot of publications. There was one recently had a lot of media coverage about the fact that it's, you know, intraperitoneal therapy is not by any means universally done in clinical practice. And as far as I know, in your clinical practice, it's not done very much. What's your take on this? You know, sometimes you read some of these pieces and it comes across as, well, why aren't we giving, you know, standard therapy and not really getting into the controversy about whether or not this really is indicated?
Right. So as I kind of alluded to, but not in detail in our little case, intraperitoneal chemotherapy has three nuances. Yes, where you put the chemotherapy, but it's also weekly and dose intense. And to sort out or disassemble the intraperitoneal piece is naive. And remember, in our case, we treated her with weekly and dose intense. We just didn't do the intraperitoneal. So how critical the intraperitoneal component is, because those patients get dose intense and weekly, is unknown. So I like this idea of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, which is weekly and dose intense. I just don't know what the contribution of administrating the chemotherapy in the belly. But we know from other trials that weekly and dose intense is important. So that's the controversy, and intraperitoneal is more toxic. So these people that say it's absolutely the way to go, we don't really know that. And you know, last time we spoke in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, there was a paper, lead article, editorial, that in those intraperitoneal studies, that there was a 10-year survival advantage, okay? Why? Because they had intraperitoneal, dose intense, and weekly. And whether it was just intraperitoneal or not, I'm not sure.
What kinds of complications concern you the most in terms of IP therapy?
So again, you can hear in my voice that I'm really focused on survivorship. Pain. It hurts to fill your belly full of chemotherapy. And is associated with that intestinal irritation, there's nausea, okay? And as you do more dose intensity, there's the chemotherapy-related side effects, whether it be neuropathy or marrow suppression.
So going back to our typical situation, the patient gets second-line treatment. What's a typical next decision that comes up?
Well, let's finish up on that, because we talked about the platinum doublets, but you didn't ask me, as you usually do, should this patient get bevacizumab? See, we have a bevacizumab-naive patient, and bevacizumab is FDA-approved, and we want our patients to get it, generally, because it's effective and generally well-tolerated. But this would be an off-label indication, see? So platinum-sensitive relapse is off-label. We have a paper that's been presented but not published that in this platinum-sensitive relapse scenario, that when bevacizumab is added to carboplatin paclitaxel retreatment, that there's a 5-month survival advantage. So again, off-label, that 5-month survival advantage missed statistical significance. It was 0.056 was the p-value, but 5 months is 5 months. So many of us are using bevacizumab, no matter what chemotherapy backbone you use. And many of us are retreating with carboplatin paclitaxel if neuropathy and alopecia is not a problem. So my go-to regimen in that setting for this patient, if I could get it reimbursed, understanding that it's off-label, would be carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab based on GOG-213. And we need to get that into the literature so your listeners can understand it. And my sense is that that's going to be a label expansion, that the existing label in platinum-resistant disease ultimately will be expanded to platinum-sensitive disease, although that's going to depend on some regulatory decisions.
Can you review the design of 213 and what it showed?
Yeah, 213, simple. Just like this patient, platinum-sensitive relapse, randomized in an open-label fashion, carboplatin paclitaxel again, carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, and there was an improvement in progression-free survival and five-month overall survival, about 37 to 42 months. 5 months OS, that's pretty good in our disease, but again, it's not gotten the attention that it deserves because it missed statistical significance, 0.056. But we'll see what the regulators say. They may say, look, that's close enough, and so we're eager to see what that does. You know, regulatory approval in ovarian cancer is important to us because it drives reimbursement. You know, the clinical trials are there, but we're moving more and more towards on-label use.
What is your experience in terms of trying to access bevacizumab in the platinum-sensitive situation? Are you usually able to get it paid for?
Yeah, so it's highly dependent on the region. As I mentioned in the beginning, I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona. We generally have no trouble. With it being FDA approved, the payers generally aren't savvy enough to say, oh, this is platinum-sensitive rather than platinum relapse. Occasionally they are. But we generally don't have a problem. But I know in other parts of the country they do.
What's your experience with bevacizumab combined with chemotherapy and ovarian cancer in terms of tolerability issues?
Right. So the most common serious adverse event is hypertension. I actually have all my patients who start on an anti-VEGF therapy monitor their blood pressures at home. Remember, I come out of OBGYN. We in the department have pregnant patients. Pregnant patients monitor their blood pressures at home for preeclampsia. So we have this whole system, and we started this years ago. And then we're pretty aggressive in treating these patients with hypertension, and I treat them myself. I don't send them to the internist. The last thing I want is for them to get malignant hypertension, posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, have a seizure. How you treat hypertension, generally it's an ACE inhibitor or a calcium channel blocker. I'm kind of an ACE inhibitor guy, lisinopril, 10 a day starting. But the real serious one is not the hypertension because we can control it. It's not the proteinuria. It's not the wound healing. It's not even the bleeding, which are generally just nosebleeds. It's the GI perforation. And GI perforation is related to the number of lines of therapy. So that's why bevacizumab is only limited to second and third line. Because when you get to fourth and fifth and sixth line, those patients are at higher risk of GI perforation. In one study, it was 11%. And also, patients who have inflammatory bowel disease, okay, are not good candidates for bevacizumab. And then if you're using it up front, patients who have had a lot of intestinal surgery and anastomosis are not good candidates. So my experience has been good, but this is still a dangerous medication. It still causes serious adverse events. And some patients, you can't get their hypertension controlled, and the discontinuation rate, you know, can be as high as 15 to 20% if not managed aggressively.
So continuing on in this case, what would be the next likely decision you would need to make?
Right. So bevacizumab is given with chemotherapy and then in maintenance. So generally, she would have another good response, and generally, she would go in bevacizumab maintenance. But what happens, the second relapse is not going to last as long as the first. So remember, her first relapse was in the 10 to 12 month range. The next relapse is going to happen, you know, half of that, which is going to be 5 to 6 months. And so now this third line treatment that she's going to have is going to be platinum resistant disease. And this is a very typical scenario. Six cycles again of carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, transition her to bevacizumab maintenance, hoping that she doesn't recur, but we know that she will.
And at the point that she does develop a recurrence, what are the thoughts that you have in that situation?
Yeah, so the three most, I told you there's three platinum-sensitive approaches, Carbogem, Carbo-PLD, and Carbopaclitaxel. Now there's three options again. weekly paclitaxel, generally 80 milligrams 3 out of 4 weeks, although you can just keep doing it without a break. PLD, generally at 40 milligrams per square meter. That's pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, 40 every 4 weeks. The label is 50. We all give 40. And then topotecan. Topotecan is also labeled. It's inconvenient because it's daily times 5. The label is 1.5 milligrams per square meter. That's probably too much here. Most of us would give maybe 1.25. We used to give a lot of weekly topotecan. It's probably less active. So 3 chemotherapy regimens, weekly paclitaxel, PLD, or topotecan, daily times 5. Now, on label here, though, you can have those same chemotherapies, those 3 of them, and add bevacizumab. But if you used it in platinum-sensitive relapse, this would now not be on label, although some people might try to keep the bevacizumab going post-progression and just start chemotherapy up again. I do that a lot. Again, it's off-label. The evidence is lacking. Maybe it's not the right thing to do. I'm not sure.
Of course, that's a common strategy in colorectal cancer where they actually have randomized data addressing that question. Looking back at the whole scenario that you just described, how would it change if you knew the patient had a BRCA germline mutation?
Boy, good question. And again, NCCN, ASCO, and our society, the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists, all 3 recommend that every patient, everyone, with an epithelial ovarian cancer be BRCA tested. And in the beginning, as I said, the chance is about 15 to 20%. As the patients respond over and over again, the chance of being BRCA positive increases because the BRCA positive patients do better. The phenotype of BRCA germline mutation is multiple responses and frequently high-grade serous, but not always. You can't figure out who's BRCA positive based on histology, age of onset, or family history. That's why we test everyone. So to this point, it probably would not have changed much, but now if she's going to fail platinum-resistant treatment, that will be her 3rd treatment. And then what's next would be 4th line, and she could be treated on label with olaparib. We've had olaparib, the first in-class PARP inhibitor, FDA approved since December 19th, 2014, approved for 4th line and beyond in patients with a BRCA deleterious or suspected deleterious germline mutation.
I want to ask you to go through some of the clinical research data addressing that question as well as other PARP inhibitors. But just to get back to BRCA testing, can you comment a little bit about the various types of assays that are done right now and how you utilize these?
So first of all, you know, who should test these patients? And I'll get back to that. But we do a lot of testing in my office. And when I test in my office, I only test for BRCA. I can counsel the patients, but there are these panels that are BRCA-like genes that are part of the HBOC, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. It takes a lot of counseling, and I don't have the expertise or time to do that. But I have no trouble in my office just testing for BRCA. The Myriad test is the one that's the companion diagnostic for olaparib. I've never had a denial for olaparib if another non-Myriad company has done the test. So you can test anyone. So the first question is, who should order the test, me or the genetic counselor? The second is, should it be BRCA alone or should it be a panel? I generally test in my office because insurance doesn't pay for counseling. Counseling is really important. But if I want her tested according to the guidelines, send her to a counselor and the insurance denies it, then the only thing that happened is she didn't get tested. So I don't. When I test out of my office, I don't mean to usurp the great work and important work of a counselor. I'm just trying to be practical because genetic counseling isn't paid for very well.
Can you talk a little bit more about the types of panels that are done and what you do if someone has, you know, some type of variant mutation?
Right. So the panels generally test for other hereditary genes, such as P53 Lee-Fermini, such as the mismatch repair genes, which we see in the Lynch syndrome. And we have guidelines on how to deal with those. But your question was a variant of undetermined significance. A variant of undetermined significance is handled as negative. So we try not to get distracted. What the provider will say, well, Brad, The mother had a VUS. I'm like, of course, how else did she inherit it? Right? So just because the mother had ovarian cancer and the daughter has a VUS doesn't mean that the variant of undetermined significance is etiologic. We inherit these genes from our parents. So the fact that it's carried on across the lineages doesn't mean it's etiologic. And most of the time, they're not attributable to the cancer. Good question.
So maybe you can comment a little bit about the available clinical research data on olaparib and ovarian cancer, and then we'll talk about other PARP inhibitors.
Sure. So back to our case, it's actually been a very nice progression, no pun intended. She now has fourth line treatment. And in fourth line, platinum sensitive and platinum resistant is no longer that important, partly because some patients are just all going to be resistant like this patient. But many patients who get a better start, remember our patient didn't get a good start because she was stage four and had to have neoadjuvant. But in the patient that had a better start because she could have a frontline operation, generally would have responded to platinum many times. And she's starting to get burned out on her platinum. And although she may be platinum sensitive, fourth line platinum may not be the right treatment for her. So this idea of platinum resistant and platinum sensitive really only applies to second and third line treatment. So what happened here, fourth line, the FDA granted accelerated approval for olaparib based on a 137 patient single arm trial. And they showed that in those patients who had measurable disease that were BRCA mutation carriers, that the response rate was 34%, pretty high for fourth line. And not only was the response rate high, but the duration of response, 7.9 months, was also high. So based on this, in the FDA's judgment, high response rate and durable response is 7.9 months, the FDA granted accelerated approval also based on the toxicity profile, which is very important because all of our medications are toxic. And the major toxicities here were fatigue, bone marrow suppression, and GI, dyspepsia, nausea, and diarrhea. So that's what happened. 137 phase two, patient phase two, 34% response rate, 7.9 month median response duration. But that's not enough. As you know, accelerated approval simply means that you got the ball rolling. And so there are lots of other trials, as you mentioned, that are ongoing to try to confirm or refute that, and lots of other PARP inhibitors in development.
Can you talk about what's known about olaparib as maintenance therapy?
Yeah, so we said that patients with BRCA mutations respond to platinum over and over again, and maybe we should use PARP inhibitor maintenance in those patients that respond. And in fact, that's the European label. Our label is fourth line and beyond. The European label is platinum-sensitive maintenance. Now, you can use platinum-sensitive maintenance in our country so long as it's fourth line, okay? So you can't use it second or third line. And that's not a subtle distinction. But platinum-sensitive maintenance, a good strategy. You can improve the PFS from about 4 months to about 11 months. In fact, that's what I told you in our case. I said she's going to recur in 4 to 5 months. These are pretty standard metrics. But in a BRCA patient, if you add olaparib, you can extend that 4 months to 11 months. And I haven't said it, but olaparib is an oral medication. And it's 400 milligrams BID. The tolerability is maybe a little better than chemotherapy, although that's one of the confirmatory trials as part of the due diligence for accelerated approval is to compare it to IV chemotherapy. But it's certainly more convenient, we can say that.
Can you talk about, for practical purposes, exactly what you do when you start a patient on olaparib? How do you counsel them? What do you tell them to expect? What kinds of medications you give to them?
Right. So as you know, we're going to central pharmacies. It creates a bureaucracy at some level, but also improves our efficiency. To get olaparib, you fill out a piece of paper, you fax it in. They deal with the insurance and everything. And then what you said, they mail the medication to the patient. So the first thing I do is I say, look, when you get this in the mail, don't start it. Come to me and let's have a on your marks, get set, go sort of encounter. And so they'll come in, they say, look, here is what I have. They have some pill boxes. I tell them that they're going to take 8 capsules. The capsules are only 50 milligrams, so 400 milligrams twice a day. I tell them not to crush or break the capsules. I tell them if they skip one, not to make it up. I tell them that they can take it with meals. I tell them that they can even take one capsule at a time. So one capsule drink, they don't need to take eight capsules, fill their mouth up, and hope they can swallow it. And then I counsel them regarding the side effects and fatigue, certainly, and that's with all our medications. I tell them that we're going to monitor their blood counts every month because anemia specifically can occur. But I spend a lot of time about GI toxicities. We talked about bevacizumab, how the Achilles heel with bevacizumab is GI perforation. The Achilles heel with olaparib is intestinal toxicity. So I say, look, you're probably going to do okay here, but you might have some nausea. And if you have some nausea, here's a prescription for ondansetron, fill it, carry it in your purse. I said, you also could get some diarrhea. Go get some Lomotil, carry it. And I said, you also can get some acid in your stomach, so go ahead and take some Protonix. Take it now. And I say, if you get the diarrhea or the nausea, take those medications. And if it doesn't help, stop it and call me. Patients think that they need to gut it out, that they're supposed to be sick. I try to empower my patients that chemotherapy-related side effects are really not tolerable. You're not supposed to have them. And so then if they get this nausea, this diarrhea, we ask them to hold it. And unlike many medications where a break requires a dose reduction, these patients frequently will acclimate. And on the label, it says that the median time to dose interruption was only 6 days, which is a week. And so I have them hold it for a week and start it again, frequently without a dose reduction because the body will acclimate to it.
And what fraction of patients using that kind of approach are able to take the drug with, you know, without major problems?
So the dose interruptions are relatively high, 30 to 40%. But the dose reductions, as I mentioned, are low, closer to 10%. Okay? So just because you have a dose interruption to let the patient acclimate doesn't mean that you need to do a dose reduction. But dose reductions are generally done for fatigue, for GI disturbances, which I just mentioned. We generally don't dose reduce for anemia. We generally transfuse the patient and keep on marching along.
I was going to ask you about anemia. When do you typically see it and how do you manage it?
So it's a cumulative toxicity. The GI toxicity can happen relatively early on, but it's cumulative. I manage it with transfusions. It would be certainly acceptable to use erythropoietin stimulating agents through their risk evaluation mitigation strategy, the REMS. It's not what we do. We use blood transfusion because it's cheap, it works, and it's safe. And the patients are coming and are familiar with our infusion center. And we do it when they're symptomatic. And every patient is symptomatic at a different time. And again, it's about survivorship. So we actually try to anticipate. So we'll have a threshold, and our nurses know that this patient is pretty durable. She becomes symptomatic at a hemoglobin of 7 or 8. So when she gets like 8-ish, before she gets to 7 and symptomatic, we'll transfuse her. Rather than have her get symptomatic and recover, because that's not accomplishing our goal of survivorship and good quality of life. Some patients get symptomatic between 8 and 9. Very few patients are symptomatic, though, above 10.
What do we know about second cancers and leukemia with olaparib?
Yeah, right? So I didn't explain how this works, but maybe now's a good time. PARP inhibitors prevent the repair of single-stranded DNA damage. PARP is an enzyme. When we have DNA damage, we get single-stranded breaks. PARP, poly-ADP ribose polymerase, repairs those single-stranded breaks. If you inhibit that enzyme, the single-stranded break becomes a double-stranded break, and double-stranded breaks are repaired through homologous recombination, which is what BRCA does. So that's the link. Single-stranded break, you can't repair it because of a PARP inhibitor. Get a double-stranded break, can't repair it because of a BRCA mutation, the cell dies, okay? So what is known about second cancers? Well, when you start inhibiting DNA repair, you can promote mutations, which is just what we said, and second cancers, specifically myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myelogenous leukemias have been reported. Now, the difficulty is it because of the PARP inhibitor? Or is it because of the other DNA damaging agents, platinum? I don't know. Let me tell you how often it happened, though. In the labeled study, it was 2%. Across the database for olaparib, which is 2,500 patients, it's 1.4%. So you get it. It's 1 to 2%. But I don't really know whether it's because of the platinums or whether it's become the PARP inhibitors. But this is an area of concern, and we are monitoring all of our patients, not only with PARP inhibitors, but with DNA damaging agents. So if you see a patient whose bone marrow doesn't recover, get a bone marrow biopsy. You might be surprised what you find.
What do we know about the responsiveness of patients with ovarian cancer, serous ovarian cancer, without BRCA mutations to PARP inhibitors and olaparib?
Yeah, so they can still respond, right? And that's why you asked me that. And why do they respond if they don't have a BRCA germline mutation? Because they have other genes that are in that pathway, the Fanconi anemia pathway, which are important in repairing those double-stranded breaks, those homologous recombination repair genes. So there are non-BRCA patients that can respond. And who are they? They're patients who respond to platinum many times, because if you can respond to platinum, you probably can't repair the DNA damage that platinum caused, and you probably have a BRCA-like abnormality.
So let's talk a little bit about new agents in ovarian cancer. Beginning, and you alluded to this before, and you're right, almost every interview I do, regardless of tumor type, we're getting into the possibility of checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1 agents in particular. We really saw some interesting data just at the ASCO meeting on that. Where are we today in terms of anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1 antibodies in ovarian cancer and gynecologic cancer in general?
Yeah, so at ASCO, there were three phase two studies of three PD-1 or PD-L1 molecules. They had response rates about what you see in lung, 15%, 15 to 20%. Now, in ovarian cancer, we say, oh, that's not very high. But in lung cancer, it translated to a survival advantage. Ovarian cancer has tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. Ovarian cancer expresses PD-L1. Ovarian cancer should be an ideal opportunity. So with those responses, there are a number of randomized trials that are launching. We have one within Energy Oncology, which is nivolumab versus nivo plus ipilimumab. So as you know, the company that makes nivo also makes ipilimumab. So it's nivo versus nivo ipi. So that's what the cooperative group is doing. But the other makers, for example, the company that makes avelumab is very aggressive now in developing and designing phase three studies. They have the largest experience of anti-PD-L1. Their phase two that was presented at ASCO had 75 patients in it. And, you know, I told you about a 15% response rate. So this is exciting, dual checkpoint inhibition. And maybe we need to do immunostimulatory molecules. So not only interfere with checkpoint inhibition, but also upregulate the inflammatory response. And those phase twos are also being done.
So in the other cancers, including lung, as you mentioned, one of the things that's been most remarkable is the duration of response and the fact that some of these patients have much longer responses than we're used to seeing with the other agents. What do we know right now? I know it's very early, though, in terms of ovarian cancer.
So we're seeing the same thing, but the experience is not nearly as great. But in the avelumab experience, there were two clear cell cancers, and both of them had a response. So that may be a single in clear cell cancers. And as you know, it was recently reported in renal cell carcinoma, exciting new data in checkpoint inhibitors. So in clear cell cancers, you know, look under the microscope the same as they do their kidney counterpart.
Any particular toxicity issues in general? Anti-PD-1 antibodies have been, PD-L1 antibodies have been very well tolerated. Obviously, there are autoimmune complications. Anything that might be different in a patient with ovarian cancer that you might want to consider?
No, not to our experience. But interestingly, and if you look at some of the other solid tumors, you're able to actually operate on patients during checkpoint inhibition. So for frontline treatment in neoadjuvant therapy, for example, we mentioned in our case, it was very difficult to add bevacizumab to frontline treatment where neoadjuvant chemotherapy and interval debulking. We're thinking about maybe checkpoint inhibitors is a better biologic frontline because we can do surgery under the umbrella of checkpoint inhibition.
So what about cervical cancer? You know, we know in head and neck cancer that HPV-related head and neck cancer seems to respond quite well to anti-PD-1 antibodies. What do we know about cervical cancer at this point?
So there was an ipilimumab trial presented at ASCO. There were some responses, but because response was the primary endpoint, it missed its primary objective. Within Energy Oncology, we have a Nevo study. It's ongoing. It's a very small study. But we have very, very little information about these. Probably the most exciting immuno-oncology approach in cervical cancer is a listeria-based vaccine. So you can take listeria and pack it full of antigens. And so then as the patient's mononuclear cells phagocytize this intravenous listeria that they're given, they can learn and be taught and reprogrammed to develop an immune response. So there have been phase two studies reported, phase twos that are ongoing, and ultimately a phase three that will launch very soon, looking at listeria-based immunotherapy with E6, which is the oncogene in HPV immunotherapy. So that's one of the ones that we're most excited about.
That's really fascinating. Another new approach that I thought was really interesting, we've been talking for quite a while now, breast cancer, about antibody-drug conjugate, TDM1, trastuzumab, memtansine, and HER2-positive disease. In lymphomas, we've been talking about brentuximab vedotin, another antibody-drug conjugate. And now I see there's an agent, IMGN853, mirvetuximab soravtansine, a folate receptor alpha targeting antibody drug conjugate. Can you talk about what that agent is and what we know about it clinically?
Right. So folate is overexpressed on epithelial ovarian cancers and endometrial cancers too, and it can be targeted selectively. And as you know, we've actually failed. Right? So we failed with ventafolide, which is the vitamin in a drug where the vitamin would bind to the receptor as a stealth sort of approach that failed. We've also failed with an antibody against folate, farletuzumab. So now this is a third attempt to have an antibody like farletuzumab, but to have this taxane-like microtubule molecule. So in the phase one study, which you're alluding to, which was presented at ASCO, there were a lot of responses. It looked pretty good. Patients who are typical in phase one studies that have lots of pretreatment, and they were seeing tumor shrinkages that were durable. So as a result of that, Immunogen, which makes this molecule, is now launching a more traditional randomized phase two trial, which you should see very soon. The idea is to open that before the end of the year.
Now, have responses been seen with endometrial cancer?
So they have, and the endometrial program is not quite as far along. These molecules have some unique side effects, and we always need to talk about side effects. They have some eye toxicity. So we're dealing with that. We're learning about whether or not the eye toxicity is related to the peak concentration or an area under the curve. And so some of these things about the doses and the schedules have delayed the development, but I think that the investigators have this figured out.
Yeah, I saw that thing about ocular toxicity. What exactly happens?
It's a corneal keratitis. It's associated with blurred vision. It's reversible. It's treated with intraocular steroids. But anything that happens with the eye gets people nervous. So I think that they're working on it. But to be clear, it's not the level of eye toxicity is probably going to interfere with the ultimate development. But eye toxicity, you know, this whole eye, MEK inhibitors, right? MEK inhibitors have a whole eye toxicity. It's a different sort of retinal problem. But eye toxicity has been identified as a unique toxicity during this drug development process.
Now, again, in breast cancer and lymphoma, one of the advantages of these types of compounds and recognizing it's a different antibody and different compound is you're delivering chemotherapy to the tumor cells, but you don't see systemic chemotherapy issues like alopecia. Is that also the case with this agent?
That is, but because it's a microtubule inhibitor, there is a little bit of neuropathy. So there is some off-target sort of toxicities, but not nearly to the degree that we would see with traditional cytotoxics.
And again, we've seen some of that neurotoxicity with these other agents. So that sounds exciting and encouraging. Just sort of keeping along the theme of new and exciting agents, we were talking about bevacizumab before related to ovarian cancer, and there were some data presented at ASCO looking at bevacizumab and endometrial cancer. What do we know about Bev and endometrial cancer?
Yeah, so endometrial cancer is a challenge. It's a challenge because these patients are generally older. They're on many, many medications, and those comorbidities in the age group make it difficult. Having said that, it appears that bevacizumab can prolong progression-free survival. In one study versus historical control, it improved overall survival, although that's probably not the best way to prove it. We use it in endometrial cancer. It's off-label. It's difficult to get it approved. It has hypertension. You know, hypertension in elderly patients is a bigger problem.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Gynecologic Oncology Update.